This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Yes, this is a global economy. No, that doesn't mean it's going to stay that way forever. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, Minnesota, today I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. The first couple of minutes of the program today are going to be on this theme. Globalization? Meh. There is no shortage of countries, this one included, where sentiments against globalization are running strong, drawbridges are being raised, or threats are being made to do so. So the last thing we need right now, I'd say, is a banking crisis. Sadly, we've already got one. Italy, the third biggest economy in the Eurozone, eighth in the world, has banks that are saddled with bad debt. The government is lining up a $20 billion bailout, raising the prospect of some economic pain for regular Italians and some questions also about that country staying in the Eurozone. Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us going from Washington.
The basic problem is many Italian banks lent money they'll never get back. These bad loans are dragging down banks that are now scared to lend in a lukewarm economy. Adam Posen is president of the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
In Italy, frankly, irresponsibly, the set of Italian banks were allowed to sell to, like, basically grandmothers and grandfathers and small investors pretty risky bonds in the banks themselves.
This financial issue is stacked on a political one. Italy has a brand new government that's just finding its feet, and it has to rescue the banks, says Irene Fennell-Honigman. She teaches international economics at Columbia University.
You cannot have a situation, particularly in the middle of the political crisis, where you suddenly have a large failure of your banks. And we have to remember that banks in Italy also do include one of the largest banks in Europe, which is UniCredit.
What happens if Rome can't pull this off? Well, Brussels could intervene. The European Union has stiff rules on bailouts that would be very painful to ordinary Italians, who could then bolt to the populist anti-EU five-star movement, says Raj Badiani, Europe economist at IHS Market.
That could result in them actually winning the general election and fulfilling one of their major policy promises, which is to hold a referendum on Italy's membership of the Eurozone European Union.
For now, that may be a long shot. But if Italy's banks and economy deteriorate, the exit conversation could grow louder. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
All right, item two on our globalization thread today. President-elect Trump, as we know, has little fondness for big international institutions. He has cast doubt on America's role in NATO. World Bank and IMF experts are anxious about his positions toward those organizations. But the one institution from which he has flatly threatened to withdraw is the WTO, the World Trade Organization. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has more on what that might mean.
The U.S. has pushed countries to open up their markets to each other for 80-plus years. That's why it helped create the WTO in 1995.
The WTO enforces a set of promises.
Andy Scheuer is a partner at Sidley Austin. The promises are don't put up trade barriers, don't put up excessive tariffs, protect a certain amount of intellectual property.
And it's a forum for dispute resolution.
It's kind of like a court where one country can sue another country for being unfair to their products. You want to know what country has filed more lawsuits at the WTO than any other? The United States.
We've done this for a wide range of industries from rice and beef and high-tech goods.
Susan Esserman is a partner at Steptoe & Johnson and a former deputy U.S. trade representative.
There would be severe consequences for the United States if we were to withdraw from the WTO.
She says countries could slap tariffs and protections willy-nilly against U.S. products. Then again, the U.S. is the world's largest economy. It could do the same to other countries willy-nilly.
That's what this debate is about. Were we better off before the WTO when we could throw our muscle around freely? Or are we better off operating within a system of rules that are the same for all countries.
Ted Alden is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says in decades past, the U.S. was the big guy in world trade, and we could set the rules because of that.
We are not as big a guy as we were back in the 1980s.
The risk when you have a bunch of big guys and no rules of the game is a fight. In this case, also known as a trade war. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Dow 20,000, not so fast. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All those holiday packages that are showing up on your doorstep or on store shelves don't just get there by themselves. You know, logistics people, the art and science of getting supplies along the chain to where they need to be and when. That is today's installment of Conversations from the Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Ann Drake is the CEO of DSC Logistics. It's not far from Chicago, Illinois, a company founded by her father in 1960, a very different time for women in the American workforce. Ann, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you.
Tell me, would you, first of all, what DSC Logistics does? It's supply chain management, which you hear a lot about, but I'm not sure anybody really grasps.
Well, thank you for asking. And you're right. It's not well known. But our company works with large Fortune 500 companies to design and plan and execute their supply chain in the U.S. A good company example might be the Smucker Company.
Oh, it's a well-known
brand.
Yes, of course.
Jams and jellies and coffee and these days dog food.
Ah,
it's
well,
a lot bigger than you might know, but they manufacture their product and send it to us in our giant distribution centers around the country. We then put it away, organize it, get ready for orders, and then process their orders and send it on its way to Walmart or a wide variety of places where consumers can buy the product.
Do you remember what it was like in business when your dad founded this company?
Yes. I never thought about going into the business ever, even as a young adult, because women didn't do those things. So I think, you know, changing the whole paradigm around women's business leadership is really important. It also was not acceptable for women. I remember going to a business golf outing once, and you know, it was pretty clear that the women didn't have the same rules, same partners, same whatever as the men. You know, we were sort of like the last folks that went out with the secretaries. So I think things have changed a lot, but we need to crack through the top.
I want to talk a little bit about this new project you're involved with. It's called Paradigm for Parity. Explain that a little bit.
It's a coalition of women business leaders. And what we're focused on is a 5-point action plan for companies that will help them achieve women's leadership over time and gives them a roadmap for how to begin to make a difference on the whole aspect of women's leadership.
As a woman who's been in corporate leadership for, 20-something years.
That's right.
Why do you think it's been so hard?
I think a lot of it is the way it's been. I think it's also because basically men are in the powerful positions in business and government today, so it's not easy to move into those arenas. But I also think one of the biggest causes is really unconscious bias. How do you get it out in the open so it can be discussed and talked about and be okay to talk about the differences between the way women and men perceive things and between the way men and women perceive leadership?
Is your experience as a female CEO different today in 2016 than it was in 1994?
Oh, it's definitely different today than it was in 1994. I think there is more acceptance of women business leaders. There was a time when I would go to conferences and customer meetings, I'd be the only woman in the room, and it was sort of lonely. Yeah. When you look at the numbers at the top, C-level jobs, board-level jobs, it's still very much a white-dominated male group. So we really want to figure out what are the real barriers, because we've all worked on efforts that haven't moved those needles much.
Ann Drake is the CEO of DSC Logistics. Also, she's active in the new project called Paradigm for Parity, about getting more women into C-level jobs. Anne, thanks very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've got more from Anne Drake in today's Corner Office podcast, including the story of how she convinced her dad to let her become a VP at the company. Here's a hint. She wrote him a letter, an actual letter. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. There's been a slow trickle of news out of Detroit the past couple of weeks that has finally coalesced into a story. General Motors, the biggest car maker in the country, is cutting about 3,300 jobs as low gas prices and the ensuing lack of demand for smaller, more fuel-efficient cars has forced the company to stop production of some of its compact models. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
GM is slashing production of smaller models, including the Chevy Cruze sedan, Chevy Camaro, and Cadillac sedan. Cornell University professor Art Wheaton, who studies labor and the auto industry, says just a few years ago, U.S. automakers sold more cars than light trucks. But, he says, things have changed.
Now we sell 60% trucks, 40% cars.
Wheaton says you can thank, in part, low gas prices for this consumer demand.
They decide that, hey, gas is cheap. I can buy a truck or an SUV, and I can put more of my stuff or more people in there.
Edmunds.com analyst Jeremy Acevedo says automakers are always adapting to changes in consumer preference.
I mean, the way that they produce vehicles and the way they produce cars, it's almost like a around-the-clock operation to accommodate demand.
That can mean laying people off, like GM is doing now. But the good news for those workers, they'll probably get hired back on. Acevedo says making an SUV requires many of the same skills as building a car.
So a lot of times it would just be as easy as adjusting the production line within a facility.
And they may keep those jobs for a while, because as McKinsey partner Hans Werner Koss says, even if gas prices go up, the demand could remain.
Those vehicles have over the years become more fuel efficient through the integration of different type of fuel-saving technologies.
Analysts say that bodes pretty well for the workers producing all those new trucks and SUVs. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
NBC has the broadcast rights to the Olympics through the 2032 Games. Cost them $7.75 billion to get those rights. And somebody has apparently been crunching the numbers and realized a couple of weeks of programming every 2 years isn't going to balance the books. NBC needs viewers, young viewers preferably. So the network has decided to team up with the U.S. and International Olympic Committees to launch an Olympic channel. Year-round, original programming and coverage of just about every sport you can think of. Relationship building with those younger viewers of a sort. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has the story.
The network will be branded as the Olympic Channel, home of Team USA. Alan Abrahamson is a sports writer and lecturer at the University of Southern California. Here's how he describes the move.
I don't want to say desperate, but very earnest quest to try to figure out how to remain relevant in our very complicated world.
Yeah, the Summer Games in Rio didn't really meet expectations. Compare it to the London Games 4 years before, and NBC saw more than a 15% drop in total viewers.
NBC has sunk $8 billion into the Olympics through 2032. Anything that helps NBC draw attention to those sports, draw bigger eyeballs during the games themselves, that is a good thing.
David Walachinsky is president of the International Society of Olympic Historians. He says this is a way for NBC to gain even more Olympic sponsors and advertising dollars, all with the hopes of grabbing younger viewers.
We can probably see NBC promoting youth-oriented sports, snowboarding, freestyle skiing.
But there's a big question, says Lisa Delpinarati, professor of sports management at George Washington University.
Is this the right media platform to reach a younger audience as more and more are cutting the cord and not watching linear programming?
Plus, she asks, how many, say, snowboarding and freestyle skiing fans are actually out there?
I'm just not sure there's enough of them to make a business case and to be successful.
NBC will find out when it launches its new channel next summer. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
Coming up.
This woman lives in Jersey. She comes in just to see these windows once a year.
Tis the season to shop. Window shop, that is. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 91 points today, 0.4%, ended at 19,974, oh so close. The NASDAQ up 26 points, about 0.5%, 54.83. The S&P 500 up 8 points, about 1/3%, 22.70. Industrial gas supplier Praxair deflated 3.75% today after announcing it's going to merge with the German firm Linde. The combined company is going to be worth about $65 billion. General Mills, makers of Cheerios, among other things, lost 2.5% today on worse-than-expected second-quarter revenue. Bond prices, well, they fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.56%. And you are listening to Marketplace. We may not know what next year is going to bring, but your listener support of Marketplace guarantees we'll all be better informed and better prepared. Make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Help us keep you up to date and well-informed wherever you are. Donate at Marketplace.org by December 31st. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Sarah Gardner has been doing a series for us the past couple of weeks built around this idea. What happens when the jobs go away? Not like completely, but when there simply aren't enough jobs for all the people we've got, automation and all of that. One possible solution is something called universal basic income. Everybody going to get a no strings attached check from the government every month. It's being tried everywhere from Silicon Valley to Finland. But as Sarah reports today, basic income got a pretty good tryout more than 40 years ago in a little town on the Canadian prairie.
In Dauphin, Manitoba, Irene Whitwell's students keep the town's Ukrainian heritage alive at a bilingual elementary school.
Dobrý den.
Dobrý den.
Okay, who knows some other words in Ukrainian?
Дякую.
Дякую means thank you.
Just up the street, an onion-domed Ukrainian Orthodox church catches the eye in this otherwise ordinary town of 8,500, where the nearest big city, Winnipeg, is over 3 hours away. In the 1970s, liberal leaders in Manitoba and the national government chose Dauphin for an experiment to see how a basic income would affect people's behavior. The town's tight-knit Ukrainian community was partly why. Researchers figured not many of them would move over the course of the five-year pilot. Whitwell was in grade school when the MINCOM experiment started. MINCOM stood for minimum income.
I think it was kind of negative in our household because we weren't getting it. Whenever people get handouts, some people really deserve it. And then some people, in my family, we thought of like that they could have made a go of their farm or whatever it was. And they just needed more effort, I guess. That's what I grew up thinking.
The MINCOM researchers were particularly interested to see if a basic income might help the working poor and unemployed. The program guaranteed a family's annual income would never fall below a basic amount. For a family of four, that was about $16,000 in today's Canadian dollars. And if they did earn some money, the MINCOM check kept coming, just at a reduced rate. So working was still rewarded. About a third of the folks in Dauphin qualified for the extra cash, but not all of them wanted it, including Whitwell's aunt.
You know, people also used to talk to her on the side, say, you know, you should get it. You could get it, you know. But I know my aunt was proud, eh?
At a downtown diner, Stephen Chakota sips a hot cup of coffee. He's 28, a local, and says he hadn't heard of MINCOM until he saw a post on Facebook 2 or 3 years ago. Unconditional free money in his hometown.
My initial thought was maybe this is some kind of fake advertisement or something, right? But then, you know, you kind of look into it a bit more and it actually happened.
So what did happen? Well, first, a new conservative government that came into power declined to analyze the experiment's results. 1,800 boxes of data sat in a warehouse for decades, until an economist at the University of Manitoba, Evelyn Forget, started digging into it. Here's what she and others have found since. The vast majority of MINCOM participants kept working. Married women did work less, but mostly to take longer maternity leaves. And families kept their teenage boys in school longer. They weren't as desperate for another breadwinner. All in all, Forget figures, not a bad deal.
The idea is that if you give people a little bit of money, and you give people a little bit of trust, people will find a way to live a reasonable life.
Forget says MINCOM also appears to have boosted well-being. Hospitalizations fell significantly, especially for mental health issues. That extra money may have relieved some of the stress of getting by. Eric Richardson remembers his parents bought a table and chairs with the subsidy. He still has the table, along with his teeth, which had never seen a dentist until MINCOM came along.
So this is a kid who's like, you know,
10 or 11 years old, first trip to the dentist, well, I had about 10 cavities, eh? So the dentist at the time, Mr. Hestak, he'd fill your teeth with no freezing, eh? So you know, you'll remember stuff like that, so.
87-year-old Betty Wallace took part in Mincom too.
Okay, so let's just check your range here, Betty.
We found Wallace in the hospital, recovering from hip surgery.
Good. And this leg is fine then? You haven't had any troubles with
that? Never had a problem.
Okay, so you've got...
Wallace and her husband were raising sheep and training saddle horses in the mid-70s. They earned the equivalent of about $24,000 in today's Canadian dollars. She says they didn't feel poor. They had a vegetable garden, plenty of wood for the cook stove, and neighbors who shared hand-me-downs. But Mincom, she says, helped them expand their business.
The best thing we did was bought a truck.
A used one-ton GMC pickup, more reliable than two others they feared couldn't handle another Manitoba winter.
We could put four horses in it. We could haul hay. We could do everything imaginable with the thing. And it pulled trailer like a charm.
Like Richardson's table, Wallace still has the truck. Irene Whitwell, the teacher at the Ukrainian bilingual school, says renewed debate about a basic income has made her rethink the 1970s experiment here.
When I think about it, reflect on it now as an adult, I think it might be a good program to encourage people that, say, are on social assistance. You know, when you're home all the time and you're not working, I think it must be depressing.
But a universal basic income where everyone gets it, including her, Whitwell says she'd first want to know the cost and how it would affect other Canadian benefits, including one she really likes, universal health care. In Dauphin, Manitoba, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The sidewalks of Manhattan are packed this time of year. There's the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center, ice skating in Central Park, and checking out the holiday windows at the big department stores like Macy's and Lord & Taylor. And yes, those window displays are a throwback to a more innocent time when we did all our shopping in actual stores rather than online. But for a lot of big brands, the artistic effort on those windows is well worth the cost. Ashley Miltite reports.
It's a brisk late afternoon in Midtown. Jolene Mujica is leading a group of 20 people wrapped in coats and scarves on a tour of New York's holiday windows. She works for a company called Windowsware, and this time of year, the tours are booked out. We're on Fifth Avenue, about to brave the crosswalk.
All right, we're going to head across the street. This is going to be a little bit of a challenging one.
A minute later, we're standing in front of a jungle scene in a window at Bergdorf Goodman. Everything is emerald green. Monkeys made from plants and beads peek out from the canopy.
It's worth noting all of the holiday windows, on average, for department stores, take about a year to construct.
What do they do with it, like, when it's over?
What do they do with this stuff when it's over? The very short and sad answer is they throw it away.
None of the stores will say how much they spend on these six-week displays. But Mujica says it's about a third of their visual merchandising budget.
We're going to cross the street, take a look at some Louis Vuitton.
A few blocks away, Jack Horoska heads creative services at Bloomingdale's. He says even with more sales happening online, it's worth it to handcraft these intricate visual feasts months in advance.
Why we do them is that there's still thousands and thousands, and in fact, more people walk by our windows every day than lived in my hometown in Montana.
He wants to impress them. And you won't find beaming Santas or cuddly polar bears here on Lexington Avenue. This year, the theme is light, and the windows feature a series of chandeliers made by different artists.
I think they're successful when we get people to stop and look and interface with them. And now that's more obvious to us because we see the Instagrams and the posts and the Twitters.
All of which, he says, keeps the store's brand in the spotlight where it wants to be. And of course, stores want foot traffic. Many do a quarter of their yearly business between November and early January. Sean Grain Carter teaches merchandising at the Fashion Institute of Technology. She says holiday windows
give you a way to be imaginative about what you might want to think about buying. And so windows, they're art.
And increasingly that art is incorporating technology, becoming more interactive. She says take one of the windows at Fashion Emporium Barney's flagship store. It features South Park's animated characters, and they talk, but it's G-rated.
Why do you think stores decorate their windows like this for the holidays?
Why do you think, stupid, they want people to come inside and buy stuff?
She says cheeky twists like this will appeal to plenty of customers as well as passers-by. Mickey Hackett is more of a traditionalist. It's early afternoon, and she's standing in front of an opulent Bergdorf Goodman display, arm-in-arm with her old friend, Jim Woods.
This woman lives in Jersey. She comes in just to see these windows once a year. We've made it a tradition over the years.
I window shop at Bergdorf's.
They meet, they tour, then they talk about old times over a decadent lunch. Sean Grain Carter of FIT says many holiday windows hint at Christmas's past and bring a sense of nostalgia.
You can look at what you like and think about things that you remember. And I think that's why the stores do it, because it conjures up these wonderful memories.
And unlike so much else in New York, it's free. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, closing the loop on that meeting at Trump Tower between the president-elect and CEOs of big tech companies last week. They got some heat for going, those CEOs did. But Apple's Tim Cook said this week in an all-staff memo, he thinks it is critical to, quote, engage with governments and that governments can affect our ability to do what we do in positive ways and in not so positive ways, end of quote. Or as Molly Wood told me last week when we talked about it, they're running publicly traded companies, you guys. All right, that's it. Out of a chilly St. Paul, back home tomorrow in a much warmer L.A. The Dow gained 91 points, about 0.4% today. The Nasdaq up 26 points, about 0.5%. The S&P 500 rose 8 points, a third of 1%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are the producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kerwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.